I think it's fair to say that everybody is tired of the tents and the decrepit RVs, including most of the people who live in them. Well, Seattle U has taken on homelessness as a university-wide issue. They have all the disciplines working on solutions. And as director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle U's Law School, Sarah Rankin told me something I hadn't heard before about how Seattle is actually spending itself into a bigger homelessness problem.
Building more housing will help. But we also need to look at bringing housing first programs to scale. That is a proven intervention, especially for people who need other services like mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment.
So housing first, does that mean just an apartment, or are we talking about some sort of, I guess what I would call assisted living, where you have an apartment that's got services attached to it, which gets pretty expensive?
Well, actually, it's interesting you say that. Yes, that is one way of describing a housing first program. Traditionally, the way that we've thought of homelessness is that in order for you to deserve housing or services, you have to prove yourself as worthy, right? You have to fix yourself first, mm-hmm. and then you'll get housing. What we know from experiments that have been done across the country is that if you give someone housing first, and don't require them to partake in those services, they eventually, through that stability, start to partake in those services and have better outcomes, lower rates of recidivism. So you mentioned that it sounds expensive. There are a number of studies that show, including one that looked at a Housing First program here in Seattle, that show that those sorts of investments are more effective and less costly than not doing it. Mm-hmm. But because people experiencing homelessness not only generate enormous costs because we house them through our criminal justice system,
right.
but they also generate, they're the highest users of emergency response. So if you look at medical and the justice system alone, those costs by not addressing homelessness far outweigh. In the millions, far outweigh the
cost of providing. Is this new information? Is this a brand new concept?
No.
Because then why is it taking so long? I mean, the latest program I heard talked about creating maybe 5,000 units over 10 years. They need 5,000 units right now.
Yeah, we need 10,000 units.
All right,
right
they
now.
Need 10,000 units right now. But I mean, but the units that they build, like the ones out at I forget what it was, Sam Point or something, was something like $250,000 each. There's not enough money to fix it that way.
So part of the problem is that we know, like I said, we started this session today talking about the solution not being complicated. We know that housing solves homelessness. So we know that these housing first programs work well, especially for chronically homeless people. The reason that we are so slow to adopt those programs is because you have to find a place to put it. I don't need to tell you, you've probably paid attention. As soon as you make an announcement that you're looking at some sort of facility where people who are experiencing homelessness are going to be located, community members lose their minds. And so it creates a real issue in terms of finding community support for locating housing first facilities.
Well, what do other cities do? Well, again, we come back to the fact that the problem seems to be worse here than other cities. Is there some fundamental defect we have that they don't? Are they just hiding them better? I mean, what is it?
I think a lot of it has to do with the political will and the community support. You talked about
this is a progressive area, right? There's no bluer area than people living in the shadow of the Space Needle, so we're told anyway, and it's all about progressive solutions to these social problems. So why is that so tough?
I think actually progressives, like, I'm not from Seattle. I've been here 8 years. I came from Chicago. In Chicago, people swing above the desk. Right. So meaning it's very clear what people are thinking from the get go. There's mm-hmm. there's no sort of pretense about how liberal anybody is or how liberal anybody isn't. I actually think that the sort of progressive persona that Seattle projects is even more dangerous than just outright stereotyping and discrimination, because people will say that they want to help people experiencing homelessness. They just don't want to have to give anything up in order to do it. And that doesn't make you progressive to say that you want to help someone and then not to engage in this sort of self-reflection and say, gee, I wonder why that person is experiencing homelessness. Could it be something that just might not be their fault? And even if it was something that's not their fault, or if it was something that is quote unquote their fault, isn't there something that we could do to help address the underlying problem of homelessness? Mm-hmm. So I think that progressive personas without true compassion and without true reflection is Seattle's problem.
Like a progressive neighborhood that doesn't want to have a safe parking lot anywhere near them.
That is precisely.
Or they don't want to upzone some of those single family neighborhoods to make it easier to build cheaper apartments for people.
You're giving wonderful examples.
Yeah.
The problem is us. We know what the solutions are. It's just that we as a community really don't want to be part of the solution. We want the solution to happen. That's what makes us look progressive, is we'll say that we want these things to happen. We don't want to have to give anything up. We don't want to have to put any skin in the game in order to come up with a solution.
Sarah Rankin, director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University. We spoke for nearly an hour, and we put the whole thing on the Ross Files podcast. Progressives may find it a little uncomfortable. Trigger warning there. But Seattle U has come up with 16 reports on this. They've studied for a long time. And she said if all those suggestions were implemented, she believes the entire problem of homelessness could be fixed in 5 years. She said you would not, in 5 years, you would not even recognize Seattle. And I think you'll want to hear what she has to say. Uncomfortable, though it may be. The postage stamp is such a simple little thing, but it can lead to so much arguing. It turns out King County voters will not have to use a stamp to mail in their ballots in this year's elections. The King County Council approved a plan yesterday to provide ballots with prepaid postage this year. Some are saying it will increase voter turnout, but others are worried it'll give King County an unfair advantage. Kyle Radio's Hannah Scott is here with both sides.
Dave, the proposals to provide prepaid postage came from King County Elections Director Julie Wise, who believes requiring a stamp for mail-in ballots is a barrier for voters.
People do not have stamps these days. They're not paying bills through the mail. They're not corresponding with friends or loved ones through the mail. And so people, therefore, just don't have stamps. And, you know, when we are looking at elections where we have turnout in the 30-40%, we need to do something about removing barriers for our voters. And I've heard from the voters of King County for many years now that a stamp is a barrier to being able to return their ballot.
So Wise pushed the idea of prepaid postage, and Councilmember Dave Upthegrove proposed the legislation, a one-time supplemental budget request for $381,000 to cover postage for the 2018 August primary and November elections. Upthegrove agrees with Wise that having to have a stamp is a barrier for voters, but he also believes prepaid postage will save the county money in the long run by providing an alternative to adding more drop boxes under a mandate that was passed by the legislature in 2016.
As of today, everyone lives within, every registered voter is within 3 miles of a drop box. These are costly to operate, not just to build, but to staff. And I believe that this holds promise. If we are to implement this measure, that we strengthen our hand in the legislature to have this perhaps be an alternative to the requirement to add another 30-plus drop boxes at a much higher expense.
The county did some test runs in a handful of special elections last year and did see an increase in voter turnout of between 6 and 10% in those three elections. But the county is facing a $25 million budget shortfall. And because of that, council members Kathy Lambert and Reagan Dunn had concerns about the nearly $400,000 price tag for this. Both voted against the plan. But it did end up passing with an amendment from Dunn that will give voters the option of using their own stamp or the prepaid option. So basically the ballots will be sent out with room for a stamp and then room for also the prepaid postage. And the county would only be charged for those that don't include a stamp on them. And he thinks it might save, you know, 10 grand or something. So there's that option. But cost isn't the biggest concern with this proposal. Secretary of State Kim Wyman had asked the county to hold off on passing prepaid postage on its own a week earlier because she wants it implemented on a statewide level rather than just a single county. Among her big concerns,
we need to be looking at its impact on the other 38 counties. When, you know, you're talking about King County, you're talking about one third of the state's voters. So you're going to treat one in every three voters differently if King County just moves ahead on this alone. And I really wanted to make sure we were looking at this comprehensively.
But County Elections Director Wise says the time for waiting is over.
Legislation for prepaid postage has been in Olympia for many, many years, and it's never passed. If we wanted to have done this before, the state could have done that. They haven't. They've chosen not to do that over the years. So though I would absolutely love to see prepaid postage being offered for the entire state someday, if we wait for the whims or promises of Olympia's going to act on it, I think we'd be paralyzed to act on anything, and we really need it to continue moving forward.
Now that the county has acted on its own, Secretary of State Wyman worries that not only will this create an unfair landscape for voters in other counties this year, but that it also may cause more confusion in the upcoming elections.
I think there's real high potential for voter confusion. The media market that King County is in, with the center being Seattle, you know, touches across the Cascades and goes almost down to Vancouver, so, and up to the Canadian border. So yes, the counties that are in that media market would be getting a mixed message. And how do you separate and tell voters that if you live in King County, you get treated one way, but if you live in Jefferson or if you live in Pierce, it's a different story.
Now, as for why the idea of prepaid postage seems to get everybody so worked up.
Any change that you make to the elections process is always viewed, how is it going to affect my party? Is this going to give us an advantage or is it going to give the other side an advantage? And both sides do it. Unfortunately, a lot of times it gets spun that some group is trying to either help their party or hurt the other party. And again, this is why it needs to be a statewide issue, because I've certainly heard people say that there's a partisan angle to why King County is doing it. So take that off the table. Equalize it for all 39 counties, and now it is no longer a partisan issue.
So Wyman asked the governor last week for $2 million in emergency funding to get prepaid postage for this year's election statewide. The governor's office told me yesterday that while he does support the idea of prepaid postage statewide, emergency funds are very limited, and they won't be able to use the emergency account for this. But they are still talking with Wyman's office, and they're trying to figure out a fix for this year's elections. And now that the county has acted on its own, there's a brand new sense of urgency here.
Yeah. Well, they're concerned because King County tends to be Democratic, and now it's going to encourage a bigger voter turnout there, and everybody else is just, but other counties are free to fight back.
Yep.
Pay for postage. I know 300,000 sounds like a lot, but not really.
And it's not. It's coming from the general fund. I know when I talked to Kathy Lambert, she was concerned because there's, you know, the King County Sheriff's Office, they need more detectives. Prosecutors need more prosecutors in the office. So, but it's a small amount of money. We'll see if it gets done on the statewide level in time.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness every morning around 7:30. With Colleen on vacation, we again turn to CBS's Steve Hartman. Finally, some love for the umpire.
In the world of minor league baseball, where most young fans want nothing more than to meet a real player, 10-year-old Vincent Steele stands alone.
What's up, man?
Vincent idolizes umpires.
It's something that we're not really used to, you know, so every fan we can get is a plus.
You know, last night there was a time somebody said, put the kid in.
Vincent is such a fan of umpires. Every game, he becomes one. He stands in the front row here at the Carolina Mudcats Stadium near Raleigh, copying their calls and mimicking their moves. He gets so into character, it's hard not to play along. For example, on this day, the manager even came over to him to report a lineup change.
Initially, we thought maybe it was like a little bit of a phase type of thing.
These are his parents.
It's a two-year phase at this point.
I don't know.
And they say it's not just on game days. It's virtually every day. At home, he stands in front of the TV and does the same routine. He sleeps next to baseballs autographed by umpires. He even visited an umpire school where he learned the proper way to call a strike, which apparently isn't to say strike.
But umpires say hoit.
Why do they say hoit?
That's what they all do.
What is out?
Out.
Okay. Ball is?
Ball.
Strike is?
I think he wanted to throw me out of this interview.
Wait, what's the deal?
He's a great kid, which may be part of the reason he's attracted to the profession.
It's leadership, rule following, fairness.
All those qualities are kind of who he is.
Obviously, Vincent would like to grow up to be an umpire someday. But even if he doesn't, hopefully he will retain the values cherished by referees of all stripes. And hopefully he will keep his room just as clean as his imaginary home plate.
Finally, love for the umpire. That's CBS's Steve Hartman reporting.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. So, can we say at this point that the Seahawks' Earl Thomas is officially in holdout mode or not?
No, because he hasn't missed anything mandatory yet. He's just not showed up for the optional extra stuff.
Which
he
is
kind of like if you...
But it's conditioning. I mean, so he's doing it presumably at home on his own, or
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see Earl in bad shape. Earl's always been in pretty impeccable shape. So, yeah, he's working out on his own, and I think Pete Carroll said he's decided phase two doesn't quite suit him yet. There's an obvious tension, and Earl's had a desire. What's counterbalanced against the fact that me saying, hey, it's not mandatory, you don't have to be here, is that Earl had said at the Pro Bowl that he couldn't see himself showing up reporting for the Seahawks without a new contract. He doesn't have a new contract yet. So we kind of wait and measure it. I look at these things in this way, that you have a business negotiation that's going on. And while that negotiation is happening, the only leverage that the player has is a withholding of service. Mm-hmm. And Earl isn't quite yet withholding service. He's just not showing up for all of the conditioning drills. So you kind of wait and see, and from his perspective, it could be, and other players have done this when they don't have a contract they like or an option wasn't exercised, is that if the team really wants complete participation in everything, including the optional stuff, well, they should feel the pressure to give the player what he wants, right?
Yeah, but you
just as far as the negotiation goes,
you've taught me that the Seahawks don't tend to extend contracts the way he's asking for.
Well, that's not they have extended contracts in exactly the way he's asking for. They did it with Marshawn Lynch, Cam Chancellor, and Michael Bennett. So, in terms of precedent, uh-huh. Earl's the one that has precedent on his side here, which is that, hey, those you've extended deals for guys at similar points in their contracts. Now, the question is, what's Earl asking, right? Because just because they've done contracts in the past, that doesn't mean it's a blank check where he just fills in the amount. And we're still in that uneasy stage where no one quite knows exactly how.
Remind me how old he is again.
He's turning 29.
Oh, 29. Because my recollection is that the problem is when somebody in near the end of their career starts asking for a contract extension.
You're exactly right. Very good, Dave. And I'm of the opinion I'd prefer not to extend him.
Yeah.
That would be my preference. None of those contract extensions that I mentioned, Bennett, Chancellor, or Lynch, have worked out in the sense that they've continued to perform into the tenure of the new money that was added. That's none of those guys have. Mm. And so I would say that shows you pretty clearly that maybe you should err on the side of letting someone else give them their final paycheck, their final contract.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about kick returns. The kick is in, so the kickoff is in, so we're still going to get kick returns. Tyler Lockett, I know who he is. Who's Rashad Penny?
The first-round draft pick out of San Diego State. Now, we do have rule changes, Dave, and you're always interested in rule changes.
Yes, I am.
The kickoff will now start. You know how they get a running start?
Yes.
On kickoff coverage? Everybody goes running? That's out. That's there. Everybody's going to start at a standstill, and there's going to be...
Well, does the kicker at least
now,
get to run?
The kicker gets a running approach.
Okay.
But everybody else can't move until the ball's kicked, and the coverage team can't run up and block those guys. They have to let those players get 10 yards before they can make contact. And most of the coverage team is going to be there within 10 to 15 yards of where the ball is kicked. You're only going to have three guys.
So this is more like
back.
Touch football now. We have to count one banana, two banana, three banana.
There's a little bit of that. There's a neutral zone. There's a spot, a demilitarized zone where you can't go and try and pick those guys off. Here's the thing is I can't remember a time where the NFL has made such a significant change to a play that will be happening in the regular season without any sort of testing. They haven't done this in the preseason. We really don't know what this is going to end up looking like. It means it's going to be an incredible opportunity for some of the creative coaches who can figure some things out or ways to take advantage of this. And I think that we're going to see more kickoff returns for touchdowns, and we're going to see better average starting field position for the offense.
Is this the end of the onside kick?
You know, I don't think so, because I don't think it would change anything of that, except you're going to have more players from the opposing team that are there closer. So it'll be more difficult for the team attempting the onside kick.
But if you can't get that run up, too, because that's where you usually go up and blast the first guy, and which I know is a safety issue. But, yeah, without a running start, I see that kind of being... Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's certainly going to make it more strategically. Here's the other thing, is if you want an onside kick, would you be better off arcing a kick 25 yards downfield. Because remember, you're not going to have the layers of a return team like you did before.
So pooch it and try to get your fastest guy to beat their fastest guy to the ball?
Exactly. Kick it to a spot where they're not, introduce some chaos, and then see who comes out of the pile with the ball.
Now you're getting to the master class, which is way beyond me. We should mention that former Mariner Danny Farquhar is out of the hospital after collapsing during the game with a brain hemorrhage. He plays with the White Sox now, but we certainly wish him well. That's pretty scary. He won't be playing for the season, however.
He's going to be out for the rest of the year, but very positive sign in terms of his recovery.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you tomorrow.
We go to Washington, D.C., where everybody's patiently awaiting an announcement from the president, 11 o'clock our time. David Farenthold joins us live from the Washington Post. So is he indeed going to fulfill his promise and pull out of the Iran deal, David?
That seems to be all the indications we're getting so far. The bigger question to me is not whether he's going to say he's pulling out, but what actually happens afterward. What does Iran do? How do the Europeans react? This deal is more complicated than it sounds, and it's been made to seem by the news coverage. So it's not like Trump can just kill it and it's dead right away. He can withdraw the U.S. from compliance with it, and that may set off repercussions that make it null. But I do believe he's going to try to start that process today.
And by withdrawing, that means that we reimpose sanctions on Iran?
Yes. Basically, we have been holding sanctions in abeyance because we signed this deal with Iran. What we would do is reimpose sanctions. And like I said, the real question is, what do the Iranians do after that? Do they try to continue to make it work with Russia and China and Europe, or do they drop it, or do they try to renegotiate it in some way that's more favorable to them? I think the least likely outcome is what Trump is saying he wants, which is that we will renegotiate the deal in a way that is better for America. The rest of the partners in that deal seem unlikely to want to renegotiate.
But my question is, has there been some planning into how we respond to their response? I mean, presumably John Bolton, who is pretty plugged into this stuff, would know that kind of thing. So do you have any inkling as to whether we are just we're pulling out and crossing our fingers, or we're pulling out and we're ready with the next chess move?
It would not be like them to have a chess move ready afterward. Maybe they do. In this case, I think the real response is going to be, we only control so much of this. So I think the next move is sort of hard to predict what the Europeans and the Iranians are going to do. I think the next move is really going to be Europe trying to pressure Iran to stay in the deal and give Iran maybe a little sweeter deal so they stay in it.
All right, next topic here. Why is the Post paying so much attention to what's going on in the Trump D.C. hotel?
Well, thanks for noticing. We have a new tracker. We're tracking all the big events where people, groups, charities, political campaigns, religious groups have had events at the Trump Hotel. And I should also say foreign embassies, to the degree they've had events at the Trump Hotel. This is the most – the Trump Hotel is, four blocks from the White House. It's become a hub for all kinds of people who want to come into town and influence the Trump administration, to get an audience with Trump himself or to meet one of his cabinet members. So it's a way to put money in the president's pocket. We've never really had a way for people to just pay the president directly as they try to influence his decisions. Before you could donate to his campaign. You could, there's ways to help him politically, but this is just putting money in Trump's pocket. And so we're trying to give people a way to see who's been paying to do that.
Is there any conflict there? I mean, it sounds to a layperson like that can't be right.
The only real consequence that there has been for this is there's something called the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution, which says that foreign states basically can't bribe the president. What the actual meaning of that word emoluments, that 18th century word and 21st century, what that 21st century meaning is, we don't know yet. A court is still trying to figure that out. So that's when foreign governments are having embassy parties or other expensive things at that hotel. There's a court case going on trying to decide if that's a violation of the Constitution.
So it feels wrong, but it might necessarily not be wrong.
Well, the way the federal conflicts of interest laws work is that they exempt the president and the vice president, the idea being that they can't recuse themselves for anything. So if a member of Congress set up a hotel and was having a bunch of events from people paying him directly that are also trying to lobby him, that could be a really big deal. Or, say like the EPA secretary did that. But the president does it. It's not technically illegal. It just, it's something we want to keep track of.
Okay, but I mean, except for Michelle Wolf, most of us believe that President Trump has plenty of money. So, who cares who books in one of his hotels? That shouldn't change the way he operates his White House, should it?
Well, I don't think we know that much about how much money President Trump has. And I don't think, to my mind, there's not a threshold. Well, maybe there is a threshold, but it's pretty low, where, you know, somebody paying the president directly isn't a big deal, right? I mean, somebody buying a bagel for $10 or for $5 at the Starbucks in the Trump Hotel is not a big deal. But somebody having a, you know, $100,000 party or a $200,000 party, I don't think that's too small for us to care about, since the money is going straight to the president.
By the way, could you give us your perspective on Rudy Giuliani? Did he really start going on television before he knew what he was supposed to say?
Well, I'm not sure. I think in his mind he knew what he was supposed to say. I don't think he actually executed. I think he had a plan, which was to sort of muddy the waters, cast doubt on Mueller's investigation, say the Stormy Daniels thing was no big deal. He just executed it really, really poorly. His main MO seemed to be going on television and admitting to new bad things that Trump did that other people weren't even aware of yet, or confirming things that people suspected but couldn't prove.
Yeah, but now he's saying, look, cut me some slack. I'm only just being read in on this, and I'll be up to speed in a few days. But in the meantime, I'll continue to guess on live television. That's what he seems to be saying.
Well, he is the president's lawyer. He also is a 73-year-old former mayor and U.S. attorney. So the idea that he's just learning how lawyers are supposed to operate when he's been a lawyer for, I don't know how many years, 40 years, to me seems a little dubious, right? Maybe he doesn't know the exact facts of this case, or he claims not to know them. But you think one of the things they would teach you as a lawyer is don't go on television and talk about things, you know, assert facts that you don't actually know.
I would think that they would have given him some talking points at least before he went on this media blitz.
Right. I saw somebody joking about this online, that Rudy is like, if you hired a lawyer to defend you from a DUI case, and he got you off of the DUI, but he got you convicted of murder. That's sort of the path that Rudy is on right now.
Kind of feels like it. Yeah.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. This is about a neighborhood shortcut, which is getting a little construction project, and it is dumping all the shortcut cars onto the main street. And Chris is going to explain why this is happening.
Yeah, this is a project, a smaller project in Puyallup, but it has bigger impacts. And we're seeing this around the region where we have these smaller projects and they really spill over onto the main lines. Shaw Road is a popular alternative to Meridian or Highway 512 in Puyallup, and for avoiding 167 into Sumner. 16,000 cars a day roll through this neighborhood street to access Sumner or Highway 410. Well, the city closed it 3 weeks ago for a major construction project for the city of Puyallup, and the impact was felt immediately. The roads that people were avoiding were suddenly full. Ted Hill is the capital projects manager for the city.
A lot more stop and go versus go and come to the stoplight. 162 and Military obviously is another way to kind of get around that area. We had complaints of that light really not being efficient with all the vehicles going down Military to 162.
And the diversion has now reached the 512-167 corridor. Cairo listener Tracy told me that her daily morning drive into Renton is now running 15 to 30 minutes longer than it usual. Got another text this morning from someone saying it's added 30 minutes to his drive, again, because all of those cars are now using 512. It's a really good example of kind of the tenuous hold that we have on our drives out there, that because of our geography and the way our roads are connected, we're really just one small crash or one small construction project away from regional gridlock. Well, since you're stuck in this thing, and you're probably going to be that way for about another 7 months or so, wow, Here's an explanation of exactly what they're doing there.
We're widening out the road to be three lanes. It's basically a two-way left turn lane, the stretch of the project, which is between Manorwood and 23rd. We're also adding in a trail on the east side and a sidewalk on the west side, which that road currently has nothing but dirt shoulders right now.
So basically what they're trying to do is they're adding a center turn lane on that stretch of the road on Shaw to prevent the daily backups from people who are turning left into their neighborhood, because there's so much cross traffic coming at you, people can't turn left. So that'll get them out of the way.
You get one vehicle trying to make a left and it is backing up and queuing up a lot of cars behind it waiting for an open spot in oncoming traffic, because each one of those locals that stop is just another queue, and the queues just start adding up and adding up and adding up.
There are detours set up to help people get to their homes, but there is no way anymore to cut through. The city's hoping people stick with the main road detours instead of speeding through some unfamiliar neighborhoods to get this thing away. But as we said, we're seeing the slowing down as much as 5 miles every morning now on 512 because of this.
Would it help if people in oncoming traffic spaced themselves to allow people to make left turns, to sort of voluntarily?
Well, you could. Yeah, I mean, that would be nice. But let's face it, when you're in your car and you're commuting, you're just focusing on you. And, you know, you don't think about that.
But that's
person.
The problem. That's basically the problem cultural everywhere. Problem we were in here, right? Which is why everything is so screwed up. The other thing is, when they commenced this project, they must have known that the traffic was going to go somewhere. Did they retime the lights in any way?
Well, that's one thing. See, the problem with this is that you run into multiple jurisdictions, as we do in our region, and you have overlaps. So the city of Puyallup doesn't open and it doesn't operate the lights where the choke points are happening now. Those are DOT lights. And so now they're talking with them and they're trying to retime. But so you have to go through multiple layers of and levels and agencies.
But we're on the same team here.
Yeah, we are. So, yeah. And so they are talking and trying to find ways, because this is going to be like this through the end of the year, maybe. So they do work and talk together to try to get their signals to work. And I mean, we're 3 weeks in, so they're working through it.